principle. Although it may not be the most important feature from the Canadian point of view, the most innovative may well be the opening up of enrollment eligibility to non-status as well as status people. For Alaska, the most innovative feature of your agreement in principle might well be the provisions relating to the use of fish and wildlife, the joint management establishment of quotas and allocation of a percentage of the quota in perpetuity to the Indian people. That is a very interesting development. Bill Rasmus and Rick Hardy, you had questions, I think. Rick Hardy.
I'm just wondering if it would be impolite of me to go ahead of the other people, but Mike had mentioned that there were three problem areas, and I only heard him refer to two of them. I was wondering what the third one was.
The third problem area is we request an advance of $10 million on the ratification of the agreement. In other words, they provided that sum to COPE when they signed the agreement in principle, and they permitted COPE a lot of leeway in terms of getting involved in the economic development in the north. They've bought into a lot of businesses. They've managed to buy a lot of expertise and given them a lot of say and influence in what's happening in the north country. We also see those type of advantages happening. If, say, for example, that government agrees to advance us $10 million where we can set up development funds and start getting involved in what is happening in the Yukon Territory. We see that as a very important lever, and that's one of the conditions we made when we signed the agreement.
Rosita Worrell and...
Alaskans are really anxious to learn from you all. I gather that there doesn't seem to be any kind of need to rush into an immediate settlement. There seems to be a difference between what happened with COPE in terms of, I gather, development in the Arctic and then what is maybe not happening in your area. I mean, do you feel like you have a lot of time to resolve this, or?
I don't know whether we have a lot of time, but the time pressures are different. On the one hand, there's a great deal of pressure on us to settle. In other words, they say that there's going to be an election. You've lost your prime minister, who is in favor of Indian interests, protecting Indian rights, seeing the entrenchment of Indian political institutions in the Canadian Constitution. The general opinion of the public may shift away from looking at land claims agreements as a mode for dealing with native peoples and resolving their grievances. And all these things are being thrown at us and saying that you have to settle now if you really want a settlement. There are a group of us who think that that's true, and there's a group of us who disagree with it. But for the most part, I think that we do still have time. We're only at the agreement in principle stage. And generally, the people in the community say, well, we'll make time. In other words, we're not gonna follow government's timetable. We still have a lot of concerns on the agreements. We still feel we need more time to review. And they're taking time. In other words, the bands haven't set a timetable on when they're going to ratify. The minister said you should ratify in February. The band says, well, February what year?
There's no imminent economic development project hanging over you.
At one time, going back to the question whether pressure to settle, one time there was a talk of a pipeline being built through the Yukon Territory. It's a result of a person going up in the Mackenzie Valley and talking to the communities, and decided that there was too much opposition in the Mackenzie. Maybe the Yukon would be a favorable route. And there was some pressure on us at that time. However, that pressure is not there now, and there's no real pressure on the Yukon people to settle right away.
Sheldon Kachetag and then Bill Erasmus.
Yes, you mentioned the fact that to approve the settlement that 10 of the 12 bands must agree. Now, my question focuses on those two bands which might not agree. Now, what recourse do they have if, in fact, 10 of the bands approve it? Are they bound by the agreement, or can they negotiate their own?
Well, our general thinking there is that in the event that the two bands, say the two bands vote against the agreement, they have the option of joining the claim settlement, or they can stay out of it. In other words, they can still go on the status quo. In other words, remain bands under the Indian Act, subject to all of the rights and privileges they would enjoy under the Indian Act and what other things they would acquire through the so-called self-government process that is happening now in the Canadian Constitution. In other words, they can take their chances with that. But the other thing too is the bands that do agree still have the full opportunity to participate in the constitutional development. In other words, we have written into our agreements a clause stating very clearly that any other benefits, rights, privileges that are required under the Canadian Constitution would be, you know, the Yukon Indian people by signing the agreement would not prejudice their participation or what rights that they may receive under the Canadian Constitution.
Right, so this settlement, even if 10 of 12 approve, is not a blanket settlement which would be applicable to all 12.
No, it's not going to be a blanket settlement. No.
Okay, one last question that I have is more or less, I would like to commend you for, number one, for operating on Indian time and not being heard in your settlement, as I'm sure you all know that the Anxious settlement was rushed. And I would also like to commend you and your leadership for looking out for the rights and also the input from your, not only your village and your village people, but also from your chiefs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've been very notorious in terms of following timetables. We've missed a lot of timetables.
Could I just ask a question that you brought up at the beginning of your presentation, and you didn't return to it. I gather that since the agreement in principle was signed, the government of Canada has proposed enlarged rights of native self-government under the Constitution, and you are concerned that even if the agreement in principle goes through, you should have the right to take advantage of any new rights of self-government that are agreed to under the Constitution. Was that what you were getting at?
Yes, I was. The recent statements made by the Prime Minister at the meetings in Ottawa on the entrenchment of self-government institutions in the Canadian Constitution have really thrown a ringer into our negotiations. In the Yukon experience, we've agreed to something, the concept of one government. In other words, having one government for the Indian people and for the non-Indian people in Yukon territory. In other words, providing one system of government with written-in guarantees for Indian participation and Indian rights and culture and languages. In other words, we'll have all these protections. But we'd be part of the total government for the Yukon territory. The statement made by the Prime Minister was in direct opposition to the statement made by his negotiator at the table. In other words, while on the one hand, in the public, they cast themselves in the light of being strong advocates of the Indian self-determination, but in dealing with Indian groups on a face-to-face basis, that offer is not on the table. In other words, the question of having our self-government Indian-type institutions was not there at the negotiating table. And it's caused our leadership, and especially our chief negotiator, to reflect on the whole of the Yukon claim and to weigh it in terms of looking down the road, seeing whether or not those promises made by the Prime Minister are real promises or merely statements?
Under your agreement, you have land and you have certain extended rights to fish and game throughout the whole of the Yukon Territory. You said that the agreement doesn't deal with self-government, but that it does contain guarantees for your language and your culture. Is that what you said? And if that's what you said, what are those guarantees?
Well, in our claim settlement, those 8,000 square miles of land would be exclusive hunting, exclusive fishing, exclusive land holding or living ownership, total management. But over the total of the Yukon Territory, we'll still maintain our hunting rights. In other words, we'll have acquired, in other words, one half of the game and one half of one quarter of the land planning regime. In other words, over the total of the territory is going to be a land planning commission, and would do the land planning for the total of Yukon Territory, and we'd have guaranteed participation. In the southern Yukon, in other words, below the 66th parallel, we'd have one quarter participation, and above the northern, dealing with COPE, we'd share one half of the planning with COPE in the north. But those are the type of guarantees that have been written into our agreements.
And you don't have one Indian language only in the Yukon, is that
right? We have some five languages.
There was a question over here. Bill Erasmus.
Thank you. The first question is more of a clarification. I heard you mention the non-renewables. You talked about, I think it was ownership as a condition in extinguishing Aboriginal rights. You talked about a certain area of subsurface rights that you would have ownership to. I didn't get the exact amount. Was that the total area of the Yukon or the 5% lands that the Yukon Indians are ended up negotiating?
Yes. First of all, let me go into this issue a little more in detail so that you have a clear understanding of what agreement we signed. In dealing with resources, we've always made it a very important part of our negotiations that we should participate not only in the ownership of resources of the subsurface on the lands that we do hold, but we also made it very clear that we should share in royalties over the total resources in the Yukon Territory. And in dealing with the governments of Canada and governments of Yukon Territory, since this is a territory and not a province, the government made it very clear to us that we're not dealing with the issue of provincehood in the Yukon. Once you deal with resources, you're talking in terms of constitutional development for the Yukon. And that forum, after the settlement of the Yukon land claims, we're going to go to another forum, and it's going to be the constitutional development of the Yukon Territory. While on the one hand they've argued that all our rights should be limited to the land claims, we have not agreed to that. In other words, following this land claim settlement, we'll change our clothes and go back to the table and start arguing on constitutional guarantees for the Indian people in the overall development of self-government in the Yukon. In other words, when Yukon becomes a province, one of the parties to that agreement will be the Indian people of the territory. And we've written into our general provisions that we would be participating fully in the, while we won't have a veto, because they don't grant vetoes to anybody, not even to the territorial government, on constitutional development in Yukon, we would be a party to those discussions. And under when we're discussing province for the Yukon, we're talking about the transfer of land and resources to the Yukon. And that's when we will write in the royalty provisions. In other words, all royalties would be the for all of Yukon territory. But in dealing with our land claims, for those 8,000 square miles of land that we've selected, we've made it very clear that we'd have full ownership of the subsurface.
Okay, did you write into your agreement that, I was just a little bit confused, did you write into the agreement that when it is time to negotiate the question of provincehood, that you would be a separate party? I understand that, or are you saying that as a rhetorical statement?
Well, they don't say we're full partners in that, but we'd be a very important part of the overall discussions on the constitutional development of the Yukon. In other words, if the Indian people decide against provincehood, I think we'd have a lot of say and influence whether or not Yukon would be granted provincehood.
Okay. The next question then is, dealing with your agreement, you mentioned that you didn't think it would take long to have the final agreement settled. You mentioned that you didn't think it would take 5 years. And I'm just thinking in my own mind, in light of the upcoming elections, federal elections, and the clear possibility that another government may step in, which may not recognize your agreement in principle. What the Council of Yukon Indians thoughts are on that, because as you may recall, the COPE people signed theirs in 78, and a certain Mr. Clark got in, and they didn't recognize the agreement in principle, or at least they were not terribly anxious to have it signed as a formal document, as a final agreement. So I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yes, there's no question in our minds now that those things do appear in the horizon. In other words, we know we're on a different schedule now. We're dealing with a government that is planning on an election. We're dealing with cabinet ministers who have the last thing on their mind dealing with Yukon land claims. They're all running for the leadership of the Liberal parties. And we realize now we're on an election timetable and everything else is more or less on hold. And we believe, while it does present us a problem in terms of getting an immediate settlement, it doesn't really affect us that much because right now our people are saying we need more time anyways. So it will be a new ball game following the election. We know that. We've come this far before, but it's never discouraged us from starting over again. We've been here about 3 times before, and because of change of governments, change of ministers, or change of negotiators, that we've had to start over again. But I think we covered a lot of ground in the last 3 years, and there's a certain momentum in terms of the overall agreement principle, which would be very hard to argue against in the event that the Indian people have accepted it. In other words, give the full authority to go ahead. I think that will carry with it a lot of momentum.
The final question I'd like to ask then, as you're probably aware, the question of time is a big factor in the minds of all Canadians, and many times developments occur affecting the North in the best interests of all Canadians, and on more than one occasion, the possibility that the federal government may legislate a claim has come up. In other words, we may take 20 years to settle, but because the Canadian government wants to settle it now, they may force the government of the day to legislate a settlement. How is that influenced, or what's your thinking along that line?
Yes, you've alluded to a very, very fact, a real fact of life here is that the Yukon public is very much in favor of seeing the settlement of the land claims as soon as possible because of the certain influences it's had over the territory. Right now, there's a the sort of a land freeze. In other words, there are no lands being allocated. Everything is held subject to the settlement of the land claims. And there's a general public feeling in the territory. They want to see the settlement as soon as possible. And they have exerted that pressure not only on us, but on the territorial government. See, the territorial government has a great deal of say in the settlement of land claims. And they've walked away from the table a couple of times. Once for 6 months, and recently they went away for about 10 days. But because of the public pressure, in other words, because of the great pressure on them, they had to go back to the table because the Yukon public made it very clear they want to see the land claims settled. And that's a real factor, too, in dealing with this land claims. We measure that, and it's an important factor, but it's not the determining factor.
Steve Iveson.
My understanding of the concept of Aboriginal self-government is that it's a general principle to be defined perhaps or hopefully on a regional basis, and that it doesn't automatically mean separate development and exclusive jurisdiction, that it can in fact mean recognized and guaranteed power and participation in government, some say over the structures that might exist and things like that. Is that the kind of understanding you have? Is that the approach you see yourself taking when you sit down to negotiate constitutional development after your claims are settled?
That's a pretty difficult question. In terms of dealing with the Constitution, you mean the constitutional development of Yukon Territory or the current constitutional development as it now happening with the First Minister of meeting?
And assume that the eventually there will be some form of recognition for the Aboriginal right to self-government. And therefore, I'm saying that I believe that that's possible to negotiate still in a public government system to build in certain principles, structures, practices that say Aboriginal self-government means this in the Yukon or the NWT in a public government system and proceed from there. That's the basis upon which negotiations would take place.
Yes, that is a real important factor in our discussions right now. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to have to review our land claims. In other words, the package we have, and look at it in terms of the how local government is set up, what provisions there are for Indian band governments. In other words, how will it work with the Constitution? Because we have written into our agreements a general provision stating very clearly anything that the other Indian people or Métis people are granted in the Constitution, that would be available to the Yukon Indian people. I don't know how the mechanics will work in terms of it being implemented in the territory once we've entrenched the whole concept of local governments, including all people of the territory. In other words, all people who live in the villages, both the non-Indians and the Indian people.
Sheldon Ketchetag.
Yes. One of the things which was absent from not only our Statehood Act, but also our Native Claim Settlement Act, was the United Nations Charter provision regarding decolonization. I would like to know what role, if any, the UN Charter provisions on decolonization will play in your determination of your political rights should Yukon territories become a province.
Well, I really don't know the answer to that question. We haven't had any role or whatever in dealing with the United Nations or their declarations on human rights or their recognition of indigenous right to self-government. We haven't dealt with that.
Yeah, I would just like to make it known for everybody that's in the process of negotiations that the United Nations Charter has provisions regarding decolonization in that the rights and political aspirations of separate and distinct indigenous populations of these colonies must be protected and encouraged. Now, as far as Alaska is concerned, the United Nations was not informed that there were natives up here in Alaska who are separate and distinct from the general population of the United States. So as a result, the United States basically had to ask permission of the United Nations to make Alaska the 49th state. And yet they are charter signatories to the UN Charter. So I would caution or at least urge you to study that particular provision in regard to the protection of your political rights and aspirations. If your people desire to be independent, then they are the government of Canada, as a signatory to the UN Charter, must not only protect that right and aspiration to independence, but they must also encourage it. So I would urge you to research that very thoroughly. Thank you.
That observation returns us, in a sense, to the themes struck by Doug Sanders when he opened the discussion on Tuesday afternoon. Are there any other questions for Mike Smith or Glenn Grady about the Yukon settlement? Well, I think that we want to thank you, Mike Smith and Glenn Grady, for a most complete analysis of the Yukon settlement, a most intriguing settlement. And right. So my thanks to you. Just one thing that I wanted to get clarified as this flow of information went by me. You have the right under the agreement to take one half the caribou and moose throughout the Yukon Territory. Did I get that right?
Under our agreement, we have, for the moose, we have the right to one half the moose. For the caribou, the woodland caribou, we have one half to the woodland caribou. In other words, not the porcupine caribou herd. The porcupine caribou herd is goes to Alaska, NWT, and we have signed, we're negotiating with the government of NWT, where the Dene people, Fort McPherson, Iqaluit, and Cope. In other words, we're entering into an agreement with them for the management and harvesting rights for the porcupine caribou herd. That'll be treated separately. However, but for the moose and caribou in the south, we have one half of the annual harvest.
The barren ground caribou are separate. Outside the settlement agreement.
Exactly. And there is written into that, you know, a basic subsistence. In other words, if the harvest falls to a certain level, then only the Indian people would have the right to harvest game. In other words, for moose, if it falls to 600 moose, then only Indian people have the exclusive right to harvest game at that time.
And your agreement relating to the fishery gives you the right to maintain your current percentage of the catch in perpetuity on each
of the river and lake systems. Yes.
Right, Walter Parker.
In the Alaska Lands Act, the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of State were told by the Congress to pursue the porcupine caribou treaty with the government of Canada. And unfortunately, this has been somewhat sandbagged by primarily by the state of Alaska, who views it as a federal intrusion into wildlife management, not a view I share, by the way. We'd help those of us who were initially involved in getting the pursuing that particular treaty that it would stand as a landmark in incorporating indigenous people on both sides of the border in the governing organization, and indeed in getting enough indigenous people on that governing board to secure a reasonable level of control. And since there has been no treaty, of course, it's still an open opportunity to proceed if the political forces can ever be reoriented to make it happen. But I just wanted to bring that up as a part of the overall future of the porcupine herd.
With which we are all concerned. Just three announcements then before we break. First of all, and this invitation is extended, as I say, not only to the panel but to the media and members of the public, there is at 5 o'clock this afternoon a reception at the Commission's office at 429 D Street in the Lusac Sohn building. 5 o'clock this afternoon there will be a reception and refreshments will be served. Bill Dubé, who is organizing the visit to the North Slope Borough's computer mapping project of the Arctic coastline tomorrow, wants those who have not signed up to see him before you go this afternoon. It will be at lunchtime tomorrow. It will be about an hour-long visit, and a bag lunch and transportation will be provided. So if you haven't signed up and you want to go, would you speak to Bill, who's right over here to my left? It's been suggested that tomorrow at 9 a.m. we should hear from the Dene Nation and the Métis, Bill Erasmus, Rick Hardy, Steve Iverson, and Steve Kakfwi have divided this up, and they will simply organize it and present it to us, and then we can question the four of them, and then we will go on to the Nunavut Constitutional Forum, and after that, and I think it will go smoothly, after that I would like to return to Australia, figuratively speaking, and because some of us have further questions we'd like to put to Steve and Stan, and we'd like to hear from Maureen Kelly about Western Australia. And then a closing word, I hope, will be forthcoming from Alf Isaac Keskitalo of Norway and Robert Peterson of Greenland. But I think it's been a good day again, and I thank you all, and I'll see you at the Commission offices, and then we will reconvene here at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Interesting, a lot of interesting things taking place.
You have to admire UII for being
so. You get tired of it, don't you? You get tired of it. You get same thing.
That doesn't.
Thank you.
12-1B fits in too.
You didn't want to hold up everything. How about the land selection? The criteria used, you know, for specific land, whether or not it was a need basis or, you know,
mainly per capita. It was on per capita and was mainly for traditional use. Selected main.